Cubs end the year 73-89. The St. Louis Cardinals, playoff bound, survived the Cubs in 14 today over on the north side. This is milestone time in the Cub half of number 8. Bill Buckner finally ended the drought. Billy Buck with the double to the opposite field, down by the warning track. That was Buck's 200th base hit of 1982. In the 13th inning, a Cub comeback, down 4-3. Scott Thompson hit one for extra bases out to right center field. Scored Ryan Sandberg. Scotty wound up with a triple. The ball game was tied at 4. Cubs really deserved to win this one, but no dice, because in the 14th, Ken Kravick fed the gopher ball to Julio Gonzalez. Cardinals a winner by a final of 5-4. And can it really be just 183 days until next year's Cub opener with Montreal? That's the ticket. It's only 10:30 a.m., and already Cub fans are lining up at Clark and Addison to see their ball club for the last time this year. Parking attendants in full swing, directing the Wrigley Field traffic.
Hat, cap, t-shirt.
Souvenir vendors are busy, too. The latest and most popular item is a Cardinals divisional championship pennant. Inside, concession workers prepare hot dogs, cold drinks, and the beer for fans waiting outside.
What do you miss most about baseball?
People and looking at all the players and meeting the players and their wives and meeting everybody else, the newsmen like you, and a lot of people.
And the little kids.
Yeah, all the children and all the fans.
On the field, first baseman Bill Buckner is taking early batting practice, honing his swing in search of his 200th hit for 1982. It's a time to say goodbye. Baseball 82 draws to a close for the Chicago Cubs. It becomes a time for reflection, and it becomes a time to look to the future.
We're a unique ball club in the fact that we've had a great August and September, something that hasn't happened with a Cub ball club in 20 or so years. Record indicates that. And the development of our young ball players. And those were the two things that we wanted to do, because we're building. And all we have to do now is hope we can have some luck in the free agency market and hope that we're blessed with a couple of good trades. And then we ought to keep continued progress with our ball club. We have only scratched the surface of what we have to do in a real tough division.
The mood inside the Cubs clubhouse is loose, very loose. Ferguson Jenkins autographing posters commemorating a 3,000th strikeout. Buckner back at his stall going over a volume of fan mail. Everyone seems satisfied about the Cubs' brisk finish, a finish of 34-24 since the 1st of August.
We had nothing to play for, and, you know, the guys came out and really worked hard, and, you know, we played every game like we were in a race, and, you know, that's just something good to see.
There were a lot of remarks early in the year about the new tradition, and people were really laughing and snickering about it, and we had some bad times. And as I reflect back on those times and look ahead to 1983, I don't think people are going to be laughing anymore.
Up in the bleachers, it's business as usual. Business being one big party. Everyone's friends, forever loyal to the Cubbies.
Everybody here is great. We have a good time, $2 have a few beers. Everybody has a good time. That's the major thing of the baseball here in the bleachers, I think.
You've been to over 70 ball games this year. What's the lure about the bleachers that brings you out day after day?
$2 a day.
Turnstiles, we're still spinning at game time. Vendors continue to hawk programs and scorecards.
Howdy, buddy, out here, program.
It was indeed a beautiful day for a ball game, but the changing color of the ivy on the outfield wall indicates it's time to close shop on another Cub to maintain the beauty of this baseball palace. Time to say goodbye to freshman ball girl Marla Collins, to Leon Durham, who's just beginning to show his enormous potential. Goodbye to Harry. So long to Vincent Liu. And what can you say to Jay Johnstone, who gave Cub fans some key hits and comic relief in good times as well as bad times? Yep, it's wait until next year time, but lots of people can hardly wait. Are you anxious for the start of 1983?
Yeah!
Now, the Cubs made news off the field tonight at a meeting involving general manager Dallas Green, manager Lee Elia, batting coach Billy Williams was fired by the Cubs tonight. Williams, of course, representing a great legacy in Cub history. Remarkably, this man who has made so many contributions to the ball club has not been offered another position within the organization. I talked to Billy about 20 minutes ago, told me he was stunned by the firing. Meanwhile, the Cubs also dropped third base coach Gordy McKenzie and bullpen coach Tom Harmon. Now let's go to that scoreboard, the National League. How about Carlton? After going 0-4, he's now won 23 for Philadelphia. Jim Fanning is through as manager of the Montreal Expos. The Reds finish with 101 losses. The Jays end with a sweep of the Mariners. The Red Sox beat the Yankees in 11. Trammell had three RBIs for the Tigers. California beat Texas in the Who Cares game. Oakland knocked off Kansas City by 3. And we'll spotlight the Canadian Football League and have more sports for you after this timeout.
The sports broadcast from Chet Kopick, who passed away at the age of 70. We welcome you in to Under the Hood with Jonathan Hood on ESPN 1000 and the ESPN app as we broadcast from our first Midwest Bank Studios. Glad to have you in with us as we keep you company until 10 o'clock. And then we hand it over to Dan Lebertard and Stu Gatz right here on ESPN 1000. Full show today. A lot of things to talk about. We will hear from Jesse Rogers on the Cubs in a matter of moments here on ESPN 1000. I will tell you that on this program here tonight, we will celebrate the life of the godfather of sports talk radio in Chicago, Chet Kopick. I am actually sitting in Chet Kopick's seat. I'm in his chair. Because for those of you that remember Chet Kopick, that was on the old loop, AM 1000, he would do the sports at night after Steve and Gary. And so I look at his career and look at his life as someone that was a broadcast icon. Comes from Indianapolis, comes to Chicago, and is able to just set the medium on fire and doing it the way he wanted to. For those that don't know, he passed away. Again, he was injured in a car accident, which was located in around Savannah, Georgia. He was a passenger in a vehicle driven by a 50-year-old woman from Hammond, Indiana, according to the South Carolina Highway Patrol. Their vehicle crossed the median and struck another vehicle head-on, which hit a third vehicle. Kopick suffered multiple injuries in the crash and was transported to Memorial University Medical Center in Savannah. He died at the hospital on Wednesday, with his family by his side, according to his former wife. The woman who was driving the car, by the way, was transported to the hospital where she was listed in serious condition. Police said that other reports said that the injuries were minor for her. But Chet Kopick, again, someone who I appreciated growing up in the business. If you are of a certain age, you remember Chet Kopick and Kopick on Sports, and how great that show was because it was so different. Before the advent of sports talk radio in 1992, Chet Kopick would have a program similar to this one on a nightly basis that you just had to listen to. And Chet meant a lot to my career as someone who actually listened to me. And I'll tell you more as we move forward throughout the show about some of the surprises I had working with Chet Kopick, actually doing a show with Chet Kopick, which is an amazing story. I'll tell you that. And we'll just talk about exactly who he was for the business. Now, for those that did not hear him or do not know who he is, we will make sure that you know exactly who he is and how special he was to Chicagoland sports fans, because for the first time ever on Under the Hood, you will hear a long-form conversation I had with Chet Kopick late last year, part of the Under the Hood podcast. This has never been heard on ESPN 1000, but it is part of my podcast. So many have heard it through the podcast, but has never been played on ESPN 1000. So you will hear snippets of our long-form conversation about his career, about some of the broadcasters in sports that he mentored, including Dan McNeil, and others. That'll all be part of the long-form conversation I had with Chet Kopick. As far as I know, it is the last long-form conversation that he had about everything that was on the record, that was recorded. So I'm pretty pleased that we have this interview to bring to you. Again, we're not going to play the entire thing because it lasts about 90 minutes, maybe almost 2 hours, but we are going to give you an idea of Chet's mindset in 2018, going into 2019, about the broadcast business, his life, some of these ups and downs. I think that you'll enjoy that. We will start playing some of that at the bottom of the hour. So for those that know Chet, that have run into Chet, that listened to Chet over the years on the same frequency on AM 1000, you will hear from Chet in his own words coming up at 7:30 right here on ESPN 1000. 312-332-ESPN, 332-3776 is our phone number. This has not been a great day for me personally because of how much Chet meant to me as someone who was an advocate for what I'm doing and what I have done in my 27 years of broadcasting. And so you'll be able to hear from Chet, and I think that you'll enjoy the conversation. We are going to hear from Jesse Rogers because the Cubs are idle today. They're 8-9 on the season, and so they're getting ready to take on the Arizona Diamondbacks. That game takes place tomorrow over at Wrigley Field. If you ever have a problem with your baseball team, if you ever have any questions about your baseball team, the easiest thing for you to do is to take on the Miami Marlins, because the Cubs were able to sweep out the Marlins, winning last night 6-0, 4-0, 7-2. And again, you look at what the Cubs went through early, and there's all these question marks, and rightfully so, by the way. It's nothing wrong with questioning your favorite team and wondering whether or not your favorite team is going to come out of the box strong. We've had a brutal winter, and all you're looking for is to see something different, right? You say, okay, my baseball team, I'm ready for my baseball team to be able to get off to a hot start so I can be optimistic as much as possible. And the way they kind of laid down against the Rangers and how they played against Atlanta on the road and losing 2 out of 3 against the Brewers is not how you want to start things. I totally get that. But I think that you can turn a corner here by taking on a young Marlins team and say, okay, whatever our problems are, our pitching is going to get better and our hitting is going to get better. And so that exactly what happened in Miami for the Cubs as they're now 8-9 in the season. I will tell you what I've always told you about this team. When you look at that lineup top to bottom, when you look at the roster as a whole, you can look at Cubs baseball and say, if you have a team that has Chris Bryant, who's not been the Chris Bryant we saw even a couple of years ago with his numbers at 219, 324, and 344, when you look at that slash line, okay, that's underachieving, no question. But Bryant in the lineup is better than nothing. Having Bryant and Rizzo and having Baez and Hayward and having a Kyle Schwarber, and you go up and down that lineup, you look at the quality in that lineup, and all you're looking forward to is to see whether or not this Cubs team is going to be able to get better offensively. And they will. I can't bet against the Cubs offensively just because they went to some doldrums early in April. They're going to be fine. Now, the question is, how does the pitching look? How does the pitching get better, especially moving forward here in that bullpen? Who can you depend on? So those question marks will be answered. As I mentioned, I usually don't even look at the one-loss record until I get to Memorial Day. But, yeah, they get off to a slow start. Doesn't mean that that's who they are. Glad that you're with us here on ESPN 1000 and the ESPN app. We turn now to a man who covers the Cubs for ESPN.com. It is Jesse Rogers. And he joins me here on Under the Hood with Jonathan Hood on ESPN 1000, the ESPN app. Hello, Jesse.
Jay Hood, how you doing tonight, my friend?
I'm well, thank you. Welcome home.
Yeah, I just got back as we speak, and I kind of like South Beach a little bit better, I got to tell you, this time of year. Just a little bit.
I figured that you would, my friend. So could you tell me through – I was just speaking earlier that, Jesse, you look at this Cubs team, and I know that there was panic. I know that there were some Cub fans that didn't like the start, but of course, you want your favorite team to get off to a better start so you're more optimistic throughout. So that's just the fans' way. I totally get that. But is there anything that stands out to you most about the first 17 games of the season for the Cubs?
Boy, that's a good question. That stands out the most. You know, I think people expect me to say something about their pitching staff, but that's not what stands out to me the most, because it's almost like what you said. I don't judge the records and the numbers until later on, but here's something. Daniel Descalso stands out to me. Maybe not the most, but he's right up there. Meaning, he's a guy I didn't know very well, and he slides in after having a slow spring training because of a shoulder injury, and he's looking great, hitting .571 with runners in scoring position and 2 outs, driving in runs all over the place. So something like that stands out to me. Cole Hamels stands out to me, 22 straight innings without a walk. And he stands out to me because he's setting a great example for everyone else. Look, I'm 35. I don't have a 98-mile-an-hour fastball. I have some deficiencies here and there. I still have a great change. But if you throw strikes, you're going to last long in the games. And you're not going to give up a lot of runs because solo home runs don't kill you. Three-run shots with two guys on because of walks kill you. And he already gave up a grand slam in game one for him with two guys on via walks. So he learned his lesson early. So that stands out for me. And you know, Brizzo's start doesn't necessarily stand out to me. Bryant's getting his timing back after not playing a lot in the second half last year. And Rizzo gets off to bad starts every year. That doesn't shock me. So it's maybe some of the secondary guys, and I don't know if I consider Hamill secondary or not, but that's what stands out to me more than anything. Now, if you want to talk about the record, I was in spring training the whole time, and we know Theo kind of raised the bar on things in the offseason, and there was such a good vibe in spring training. So, yes, in a way, it did surprise me to start 1-6, 2-7 for this club. So, but eliminate that. Any contender, we've seen this year after year after year, can start under 500, can have slow starts. Over the last 5 years, this is the first time the Cubs have had this slow of a start, so maybe they were due for one. And that is, again, spring training vibes and records and all the talk and rhetoric is a bunch of bunk. It doesn't matter. What matters is March 28th or April 1st. And so if you throw away the rhetoric, this start is just a start. You know, it happens. Sometimes you're under 500. But some of those individual, maybe secondary guys stand out more than some of the failures, to be honest.
Jesse Rogers covers the Cubs for ESPN.com. He joins me, Jonathan Hood, on Under the Hood on ESPN 1000 and the ESPN app. Well, one thing that I will jump to conclusions on is Kyle Hendricks. Jesse, he ain't fooling anybody. I mean, it's one thing if you don't have a lot of velocity, but if there's no movement and it's straight, you get what you get. That's an 0-3 record that he's earned. It is not good, and I'm wondering what are some of the coaches saying about Hendricks and how that can get better?
It's a balance thing. I just talked to Hadavi yesterday about it. He's trying to find the right balance. I mean, with him, it's not really mental. It's not really completely physical either. It's just rhythm. And like they said, balance, which is just very, you know, sort of technical. What does that mean? You know, he's just not in the right rhythm and balance to repeat his delivery time in and time out. That's what he has to do to be successful. Now, here's the other guy that's a slow starter is Hendricks. I half joked with Joe Maddon about this yesterday. With some of these guys, you I think as a manager after time, you just kind of wait till the calendar turns to May. And I think that's kind of what you're in with Hendricks, and that's kind of what you're in with Rizzo. Now, you'd love for them to put a six-month season together or at least have a good start. It just hasn't happened for Hendricks since 16, and I don't know, when the last time Rizzo had a good April. So some guys, you just kind of wait until the calendar gets them into rhythm, both at the plate and on the mound. But you're not wrong. He's not fooling anybody right now. We'll see what he does tomorrow against the Diamondbacks, who just came off a sweep in Atlanta, by the way.
My friend, did you cover a Cubs-Marlins game that drew 8,000 people? Was it legit 8,000 or was it actually less than that?
No, it was about 8,000. I mean, I don't think you're going to lie. If you're going to lie, you're going to make it 15, 20,000. You're not going to lie and announce 8,000. And I will see that's something the Marlins went to once Jeter took over, and I don't know what the reasoning was for, because it obviously makes them look worse, but some parks announce paid tickets, you know, and that includes all sorts of things, promotional stuff and charity stuff. They announce people in the building. I believe they started that last year under Jeter. Mm-hmm. So that number is really low. I mean, I was at spring training and the Cubs drew 15,000 every home game. So think about that. Spring games for the Cubs drew more than the Marlins regular season games. I will say my folks who are in their 80s live down there. Tuesday's game, easy in and out when there's only 9,000 in the ballpark. Easy in and out of the ballpark and the parking garage, everything else. So, look, if you're a Cub fan, you loved it because you had your pick of your litter of seats. It was easy in and out. And, of course, you made the Cubs feel like a home team. But, yeah, it was sparse. And that's too bad. With the roof open, Jay Hood, the place is nice. It's a nice ballpark with the roof open. You see the skyline in the backyard, background there of Miami. And I've never been down there with it full. Never. I'd love to be in that stadium with the roof open and the place full. I don't know when it's going to happen, though.
I need to talk to Talk Show Jesse for a second. Is he around?
Fire away.
Okay,
fire
I need away. I need talk show Justy, because I don't think that anyone on the station has asked you about the Tim Anderson situation with the Royals. That whole thing with the unwritten baseball rules. So the incident happens, for those that don't know, Tim Anderson hits a home run. He spikes his bat, makes a complete 360 in the box. He's celebrating because he's happy he hit a home run. The starting pitcher for the Royals hits Anderson the backside. Next time he comes up, Anderson doesn't like it. Bench is clear. And then there's Rick Renteria telling, you know, the Royals staff, just get back. You know, I'll handle my players. You handle yours. And there's Joe West, that idiot. Joe West grabs Renteria and spins him around, grabs him by the arm. That's one thing. The other thing is, that I'm trying to get to, is the baseball rules. So in 2019, is it still a good idea that if someone hits a home run and he spikes his bat, that you have the right to hit him in the ass?
No. And we're moving in that direction where the pitcher is getting condemned more and more. But we're not quite there yet. Sometimes it takes some consternation, a few bench-clearing brawls, some moments like that, and then eventually we will get to that point. We'll get to that point. John Lester will retire. Guys, you know what I mean? The old school will eventually move on out, and the new school will take over. But there will be some moments that happen like we saw yesterday. Now, I do think we agree, and I only saw the replay once, but of Anderson's home run. I do think we agree there is a line for any batter, you know, that he probably shouldn't cross. I mean, Jimmy Pearsall ran the bases backward on, I think, his 100th home run, something like that.
Right.
I mean, there is a line. Throwing the bat away, I love. I mean, the line should not be about the bat. But if you are taking your time around the bases, running backwards around, I mean, there is probably a line for anybody in the game, you know, probably shouldn't cross, whether that be a pitcher on a strikeout. I mean, Strope, gets near that line when he ends the inning on a strikeout, but he's not crossing it when he celebrates. So I'm all for it. I don't think Tim Anderson crossed the line. I don't think there are many guys that do cross the line. And I think we will eventually get to a point where it's accepted and there is no, you know, bean brawl and bench clearing situation later, but we're not quite there yet. We're not quite there, but we are in a situation where the pitcher is getting condemned by the masses more and more.
Well, you know that the next team that you're covering here with the Cubs and Diamondbacks, Mr. Bob Brenly will be in with the broadcast. And this is the same guy that said, you know, if you got a no-hitter going, if you lay down a bunt against the guy that's throwing a no-hitter, that's against baseball rules. And I love Bob, but he's completely wrong about that.
But he's absolutely wrong.
He's the ultimate guy with the unwritten rules.
Yeah, I mean, look, first of all, if it's a 1-0 game, you're going to condemn someone for bunting to get on base to help his team. That's completely BS. And even if it's a 10-0 game, I'm sorry, bunting's part of it. I'm with you. Bob is old school. You know, John Lester is old school, and I love John Lester, but he knows he's pushing uphill on this subject. He knows he's going against the grain. And Brenly kind of knows it too, but Brenly just doesn't care. He's up in the booth. He's not going to manage again. He can say what he wants. So, again, it's an uphill battle for those old school guys where, I don't know, a decade ago, those guys were the norm, and the guys trying to have fun and stuff were the exception. It's now the other way around. The bat tossing and stuff is becoming more of the norm, and the guys that are against it are the exception, I believe. At least we're moving in that direction. I truly believe that.
I heard you earlier, but I'd like for you to tell my audience about what your memories of Chet Kopech, because we're going to play. I had a long-form conversation with Chet. We're going to play in our next half hour on my Under the Hood podcast. I think it's the – it might be the only long-form podcast that he's done in a while, but what are your memories of Chet growing up listening to his show?
Well, first of all, I look forward to hearing that because, it's probably one of his last interviews for sure. It was just a real interesting listen at the beginning of sports talk radio. It really was. It was the first guy doing long-form interviews, like you just mentioned, doing long interviews on the radio, sports talk radio interviews. You know, it wasn't just callers calling in and getting their sounding off. It was, in fact, he didn't take a lot of calls. It was good long form interviews. Mm-hmm. And if you love sports, you love that kind of stuff. So to this day, I love that, listening to that kind of, I love listening to you talking to somebody. So that's what you remember. And obviously the flamboyant personality that went along with it. Right. You know, you got to have personality if you're going to host 4 hours on the radio, you have to. So he was great. He was great at it. That was it. That was the beginning of sports talk radio in Chicago. And then working with him throughout the years, he was a great team player. He really was. He cared about the people he worked with, even with that flamboyancy. You know, from the outside looking in, some people might say, oh, he's bombastic, he's flamboyant, he only cares about himself. But he wasn't like that. He really wasn't. He truly did care about other people on and off, you know, the radio. I worked with him, as you did, for a short period of time, but I've known him for years, and he was always good. He's always friendly and always had a story to tell. And yeah, he was controversial, but the great ones are. So those are some of my memories. And it's just so strange. I mean, to hear that he's gone because of a car accident. It's one of those things that's going to take a couple days to sink in.
Yeah, absolutely. I understand you have a book out. Could you tell people about it?
I was just talking to John Vincent about Try Not to Suck. John Vincent, of course, the famous national anthem singer. He was down in Miami rooting on the Cubs, of course, with his World Series ring on. He had first-class seats back on United. I was in 20C. That's all I can tell you there. But we were talking about the book and that it's out in paperback. And, you know, it might be, Good Friday is tomorrow. It might be too late for Good Friday, but it's not too late for Passover and Easter this weekend. Pick up a copy of Try Not to Suck. Give it as a nice Easter gift to mom because of the meal she just cooked for you. It's available at bookstores all over, the hardcover and the paperback, which just came out last month.
My friend, as always, I appreciate your time. Thanks for coming on the show.
J-Hood, have a great night. I'm going to listen to you and Kopic for sure. Take care, man.
Absolutely. It is Jesse Rogers. You can follow him on Twitter at ESPN Shy Cubs, the latest on the Cubs as they get ready to take on the Diamondbacks tomorrow. Again, Bob Brindley will be in town. Ask him about those unwritten rules if you get a chance to see Bob over at the Friendly Confines. Coming up next, for the first time ever, you'll hear Chet Kopic and I sit down and talk about his career in broadcasting. That'll be coming up next. As you're listening to Under the Hood.
Jonathan Hood on ESPN 1000. Under the Hood with Jonathan Hood. Weeknights on ESPN 1000 and the ESPN app.
Under the Hood with Jonathan Hood on ESPN 1000 and the ESPN app. Glad that you're with us. We'll talk about the Bears in the NFL draft coming up at 8 o'clock. We'll hear from Brad Edwards from College Game Day on ESPN Radio. We'll hear from him coming up at 8:10. Also, we will hear from Bobby Carpenter, first time on the show from ESPN Radio, as well as 97.1 The Fan in Columbus. We'll get his thoughts about the NFL draft as well. And because it's right around the corner, it's next Thursday, so we're going to get their thoughts on some of the college prospects that the Bears could be looking at. Well, as I mentioned at the top of the show, we talked about the passing of the great Chet Kopic, the godfather of sports talk radio. Before the advent of sports talk radio, there was Chet Kopic in this chair on AM 1000, The Loop, and doing talk shows every night. And I was blessed to be able to have a one-on-one conversation with Chet Kopic, long-form conversation with Chet about his career, his ups and downs, his relationships with some of the people in the media. And this portion of our conversation, we talk about, looking at how he looks at the broadcast business today and how he looked at it when he started, because it has changed so much. So let's go into that conversation with Chet about how the business looked back when he started versus now. Chet, speaking of stories, I think that we should tell the story of how competitive it was with you in Chicago at the anchor desk for Channel 5. The way you, Johnny Morris, going back and forth, and how it was very difficult for us as sports fans to choose, who should we watch every night at 6 and 10? How competitive was 2-5-7 and 9 during that time to try to not just for television ratings, but to get the story and tell the story uniquely?
John, it was so competitive that Johnny Morris and I didn't speak for years. And Tim and I really didn't become close until I had left TV and had joined old WLUP AM 1000 during the Brandmeier, Kevin, Stephen, Gary era. I mean, we just didn't like each other. The competition was fierce. It was a bloodlet. And, if you didn't get the story, your news director was furious. And you were on the red carpet. I mean, not the red carpet. You were on the dead carpet because you had to come up with answers. I remember, you know, one grand example is this. Les Grobstein, I love him. But, you know, Les is often regarded as the only person who had audio of the famous rant by Lee Ilya. He wasn't. I remember that Friday. It was a misty, rotten day outside. You know, the Cubs are playing their usual slovenly brand of ball against the Dodgers. They're going nowhere. And I'm beginning to wonder about what's going on with Dallas Green and Lee Ilya, whole nine yards. And so I told Mark Gene Greco, who at that time was my weekend man, I said, you know what, go out to Cubs Park and get a hold of a guy like Boa. Get a hold of a hothead. Maybe somebody will finally pop off about, you know, how bad this club is. Well, Mark got out there just in time to get maybe two-thirds of Ilya's rant. So we come back, we run it, and then, you know, old showbiz here really gets carried away. I go on the 10, I run the tape, and I call for the firing of both Dallas Green and Lee Ilya. Ilya for, you know, calling Cub fans a bunch of bums, and Green for not firing Ilya. And, you know, fortunately I came to my senses and went to Cubs Park the following day and apologized to both of them. But Johnny was aware, after watching the 6, that we had the tape. He called us up, got a hold of Jeff Davis, my producer, who has authored several wonderful books, among them Papa Bear, The Life and Legacy of George Halas. And Jeff wouldn't give him the tape. And Johnny went ahead and called Monty Newman, our general manager, and Monty wouldn't give up the tape. And it became a big story in both the Tribune and Sun-Times. And it only escalated the feud between Johnny and myself. But, you know, Hoodie, I have to face the facts. I had a wonderful time at Channel 5. There were some people there who weren't particularly happy with me, weren't particularly fond of the fact that I was there. No names need be mentioned at this time because we're 35 years past the firing. But I don't think I was ever as heartbroken about anything as I was about losing the job at Channel 5, because for me, from the time I was about 10 years old, my dream, I had two dreams in life. One I will never fulfill, one I did fulfill. I wanted to be an O&O sportscaster in Chicago. That was number one. Two, I always dreamed that somehow, someday, I would become the voice of the Chicago Bears. And that's why I took the job as public address announcer for the Bears back in 1974. At that time, Jack Brickhouse, godfather of my daughter, and Cup, Irv Kupcinet, the legendary gossip columnist with the Bears broadcast team, and I got hired. I was paid a whopping $35 a game the first year. And John, if you can imagine this, we did the public address walking up and down the field. Now imagine being at the southeast end of Soldier Field, and a play concludes on the 13-yard line on the west end of Soldier Field. Now try and name the tacklers.
Right, you
know,
exactly.
I mean,
right.
Believe me, I know why the guy in the 15th row was yelling out, "Hey, Kopic, you moron, that wasn't Bryant, that was Smith who made the tackle." But that was my lifelong dream. It'll never be fulfilled. I've reconciled it. I wanted in the worst way to be the voice of the Chicago Bears. And by the way, this September, I will attend my 68th consecutive Chicago Bears home opener, if you can imagine that, which I think is probably a record. A record for what? I don't know, because my ex-wife would tell you, it shows you how limited my life has really been.
I'm glad you told that story, because I think it's important that even in 2018, Chet, it's still important to be able to be unique in that time slot. You have 3 minutes. And I have to admire a Dale Hansen from Dallas.
Oh, yeah.
That pretty much says, here's the scores that's scrolling at the bottom of the screen, but I've got a 3-minute commentary that you must hear.
Yeah.
And now it's something that you must hear when Dale Hansen's on, because you know it's just not going to be the highlights from 24 hours ago. And I wish that we'd have that more often here in the city.
You bring up a very good point. I don't know what kind of rope is placed on the sportscasters here in Chicago today, but I do know, John, it's not the Wild Wild West, like it was when I was doing television back in the day, where, you know, news directors not only welcomed commentary, they darn well demanded commentary from you. They wanted your opinions. I mean, they wanted you to rattle cages. And, you know, I had no problem with that whatsoever. And again, you know, the one thing you have to get used to, John, in this business is, if you're going to go in my direction, and the direction that I chose to go with is that you're not going to be everybody's All-American. A lot of people are going to hate your guts. I mean, I was looking at one tweet today from a guy who clearly has been hating me for 30 years. And the only positive thing to the tweet is he probably won't sock his wife tonight after dinner. Mm-hmm. But you have to accept the fact that you're going to be booed. And I mean, I remember when I was in Indianapolis, you know, first of all, I was from Chicago, which made me a natural born villain. Then I get down there, and what do I do 3 weeks into my run? I call out Bob Knight for being a guy with no public relations tact. You would have thought that I had called for the end of motherhood, the Pope, and an apple pie, for God's sakes. And the irony is, eventually, Bob Knight and I became very good friends and have been friends for well over 30 years. But I've told this to young people, and I get, even John, to this day, although I'm not, shall we say, traditionally active in broadcasting, I've had a wonderful job with the Chicago Blackhawks that I absolutely treasure. I love making radio appearances, love doing commercial work, things like that. Do I miss the day-by-day vibe of doing sports talk radio? The answer is not really. Only on those given days, John, when I think about, you know, for example, where we were at the old Loop back in 91, 92, when the Bulls were at the apex, and I was hosting Bulls basketball as well as doing Copic on Sports. On those nights when there was a big story and I just knew in my heart, I knew in my gut that nobody on TV, radio, or the newspapers was going to beat me. Now, sometimes they did. But, I mean, I really believe that. And, you know, my devotion to the business, my love of the profession cost me a marriage. And, you know, I cannot blame my former wife, Anna, for wanting to, you know, call it a day after 30 years because, you know, she basically had to accept that I was married. I was married to a microphone. I mean, son of a gun, when I was doing Copic on Sports on the old Loop, and we were on from 7 to 10 at night if we weren't doing basketball, I'd get up in the morning and drive and go to the East Bank Club and work out, read the newspapers there. And, you know, there were no cell phones in those days, so I'm calling the office about every 15 minutes saying, you know, book this guy, get Bill Walton, get Red Holzman, get Brendan Sir, get Chuck Daly, you know, get me Dick Stanfield, get me Bob Avellini, you know, whomever. I was married to the job. And I mean, on nights, John, and I've never said this before to anybody, on nights when I felt like the show was bad, I'd drive for a couple hours. I would just, you know what I'd do? I mean, this is kind of peculiar. In fact, it's downright weird when you get to it. I would leave the Hancock Building, get on the Ryan, drive south, get off on 47th Street, go west over to Halstead, and then drive south, and I'd stop by the old International Amphitheater. And I would think about seeing Buddy Rogers and Bearcat Wright and Dick the Bruiser and the Crusher and the Valiant Brothers and the Rolling Stones and Deep Purple and Elvis Presley, and I can go on and on with people I saw in that building, interviewing John McEnroe there. And I would just sit there and I would think about all the great moments and how much that one particular building, more than any building in the city of Chicago, shaped and defined my personality. But if I had one trait, which I wish I desperately had changed when I was in the business on a full-time basis, it was the fact that I didn't have enough common sense to realize it was only a broadcast. It wasn't Armageddon. It wasn't the Tet Offensive. It wasn't the Mekong Delta. We were just talking about basketball or baseball or, you know, the Bears. But I took it way too personally. And as a result, you know, I loved my producers, and I loved being able to help a guy like Bruce Levine, who's a rock of Gibraltar in this profession. He was here at ESPN for a number of years before he made a move. Mm-hmm. And being able to help a guy like Bruce provided me with great gratification. Being able to help a guy like Dan McNeil provided me with great gratification. Now, some people you help never forget. Some people you help will forget. And, John, what that boils down to is, you know, sometimes when you're the lead dog, people can get to a point where they go, you know what? If this big slob would just get out of the way, I could do his job. And I can't blame people for that because it's human nature. And my gosh, somebody told me, I think it was Eddie Doucette, when he was the voice of the Milwaukee Bucks, and I was producing the Bucks radio network in 70-71, the year they won the NBA title with Ferdinand, Louis Alcindor, Kareem, and Oscar Roberts. And he said, kid, if you have an ego, if you haven't got an ego, get one in a hurry because you're going to need it. And in this business, you've got to have an ego. I mean, you have to believe that you are damn good or you're not going to last an hour because there is just too much pressure, right? Am I lying?
No, there's no question about it. And let's just circle back to what you're talking about when you feel like you've had a bad show. Of course, Chet, the thing is, as a listener, you never know if the person, what a person's going through as far as a bad show. You feel like you're informed, you've prepared all day, and then all of a sudden you've missed something in an interview. The thing that will just completely haunt you is, and it's actually, and I try to tell students this also, it's so difficult to have an interview and think that you've absolutely nailed it, because when you're driving home, you think, God damn it, I missed something there. Why didn't I ask him that? Because that could have hit the papers the next day. If I would have asked him this, or if I would have asked him in a different way, if I didn't ask him in a yes-no fashion, those are the things that keep you up at night.
It just does. It's much tougher now than it was when I was doing it, let's say as far back as 2005, 2006. Why? Because the explosion of social media, Twitter, I mean, good Lord. If I was doing it today, and people ask me, would you like to do sports talk radio one more time? And I'll say, listen, I'm going to be 70 years old in April. I've had a wonderful run. I feel very, very blessed. I'm in great health, save for the fact that I had a lousy cheeseburger today, which is going to be doing a number on my stomach until about 3 o'clock in the morning. But the real answer is this, John. I would only, I think, really want to do it on those days, and you can relate to this, when the big story is out there. Like today, for example, I find this kind of interesting, or this week, you know, speculation that LeBron James might join the Golden State Warriors. Mm-hmm. Well, it's not going to happen, but it's great fodder. It's terrific fodder. Because all of a sudden, now you can speculate, does he join the Lakers? Does he join Houston? Does he wind up in Oklahoma City? You know, it's clear that LeBron is not happy right now with what's going on in Cleveland. I'm surprised that Tyronn Lue, a wonderful guy, is still on the bench. I really don't know where the club is going. I don't think that the current demise of Kevin Love is going to hurt him a bit, because I think every time Love does something positive, he does three things to get you beat. But, I mean, on a day like this, when there is all this talk about LeBron, I'd love to have a microphone. I'd love to be able to weigh in. And I suppose that's never going to change. You know, it's interesting. You know, I think, John, in this business, it's kind of like being a fighter, in that you're an amateur, then you're an up-and-comer, then you're a semi-main eventer, then you're a main eventer, then you get a title shot. Then after that run, you become a great fighter. Then you become an opponent. And then eventually, in the eyes of the public, and you have to accept this, they see you as being something of a has-been. And believe me, I know there are a lot of people who are hearing us right now who think I'm a has-been. And again, I don't blame them for that a bit, because I'm not an everyday presence. You know, now I like to believe that I'm still relevant, that I'm still as sharp as I ever have been, but you can't con the public and say, I'm as vital as Jonathan Hood. I'm as vital as this guy is or that guy is, because I haven't got the everyday platform. And that's just being honest with yourself. And you find, John, as you go along in this racket, and I've always, you know, one thing I've always admired about you is how classy you've been about the way you've conducted yourself. You know, I mean, you've just been an example as to how one should behave professionally, behave on a level in terms of how you conduct yourself in a newsroom. I mean, you're a model. You're a model prisoner in this penitentiary of life that we have ourselves in, John. But, you know, would I change things if I could do it all over again? Maybe. Maybe at Channel 5, instead of trying to run the world, maybe I would have said, you know what, I just can't win them all. It's a news-driven operation. Ron Majors, Carol Marine, Linda Yu, they are the stars. Mm-hmm. They look upon me as being something they have to run. So maybe when they want me to tone it down a little bit, maybe I should have done it. But then again, I can walk away saying I did it my way, which means a lot to me. The other great regret, John, is when I went to New York, and people said I was crazy. I went to New York in 94 because I left, you know, a terrific job here with AM 1000. Mm-hmm. As happy as a clam. I felt terrible because I was uprooting my family, moving them from Lincoln Park to Manhasset, Long Island, about 20 miles from Midtown Manhattan in the Garden. But I couldn't resist the ego within me, John. I couldn't resist the idea of going to the biggest playpen in the world and finding out, number one, could I compete? And two, could I win over the critics? And I did. And I had a great three-year run there. And unfortunately, you know, Chuck Dolan elected to shut down and sell our operation. And it was a great, great disappointment. I mean, terrible disappointment. And if I could change that, because I really believe, John, in 1994 we debuted, my first guest was Doc Rivers. And this was classic New York. You'll remember this. Game 7, Eastern Conference Finals, 94, in the Garden, Bulls, Knicks, the foul on Pippen, called by, I believe, Hugh Hollins. The Knicks escape, and they go to the NBA Finals.
Right.
Well, I'm on the air that night. Doc Rivers is injured, and we've arranged to have a limo meet Doc on 8th Avenue to take him out to Long Island, where our studios were, to do the show. And we knew we had 2.5 hours, so we thought, you know, we can't possibly go wrong. Well, about 15 minutes before showtime, Mike Lardner, who brought me out there, hell of a guy, said, Chester, welcome to New York. Doc is stuck in traffic on the Triborough Bridge. Just start ad-libbing until I say shut up. So I ad-libbed the first half an hour of the show. Mm-hmm. And really, I enjoyed that. I mean, people who know me know that I rarely have worked with a script in my life. You know, my feeling is, and that's why I've always admired Jackie Gleason, and I can still watch The Honeymooners, which are 10,000 years old, and get a kick out of them because I know that Gleason never rehearsed. And that Gleason is ad-libbing half the show.
Right.
And I just love that kind of spontaneity. So that's kind of what, and I also, John, you'll remember this. Jack Brickhouse was the greatest ad-libber I ever saw. People think of Jack, okay, hey, voice of the Cubs. Good morning, voice of the White Sox, voice of the Bears, voice of the Bulls. He did barn dances at the Aragon Ballroom. He did ballroom dancing at the Edgewater Beach. He did boxing at Rainbow Arena. He did wrestling from Marigold. He covered political conventions. He's the most consummate, complete broadcaster Chicago ever turned out. And he told me when I was about 11, 12 years old, I was sitting in his den one day, and I used to sit in that den, John. I'd look at the awards, and I'd look at all of his books, and I'd go, my gosh, if I could just be like this someday. And you can imagine what it was like for me to eventually MC events with Jack. But he did tell me on that given day, kid, I want you to understand something about this business. You think you want to be a sportscaster. Now I'm going to draw a comparison. Being a broadcaster is not all that different than being a doctor. Before you become a brain surgeon, you've got to become a general practitioner, which means before you become a full-blown sportscaster, you should be able to do news, do some weather, do a farm report if you have to, you know, do commercial work. And I really took that to heart. And that, John, is how I really believe I was able to create really a tremendous income doing commercial work in the 80s, 90s, into the 21st century. You may recall I was the voice of Chicagoland Chevrolet with Michael Jordan for 10 years, and that gig might still be going if I hadn't moved to New York.
An aerodynamic wonder.
Exactly. You know, I mean, when I look back and I think about the move to New York, it was so damn selfish on my part.
As I combine all the juice from the mind, heal up, wheel up, bring it back, come rewind.
Jonathan Hood on ESPN 1000.